Hey everyone, I'm Aaron Noonan. Welcome along to the V8 Sleuth podcast. And on this episode, we're talking to a driver that I spent ages trying to find a time with to sit down and chat. And I was amazed that of all the podcasts that are out there at the moment, no one had spent the time to stop and talk to this driver. Ironically, she was born in a country where motor racing was banned in the 1950s, but that hasn't really stopped her. She's raced in all sorts of championships around the world, from IndyCar to Formula E, and for the last few years in the Virgin Australia Supercars Championship. I think you can probably guess who the guest is. It's Simona Di Silvestro. Now, there's plenty of highlights of our chat, which I really enjoyed sitting in our office having a chat with her. She tells the story of what got her into motor racing in the first place, the world-famous teammate that she had in a junior category in the US, which wasn't a massive name in motorsport, but if you're a TV or a pop culture fan or viewer, you'll know who this guy is. We asked her how she got her nickname, the Iron Maiden, and what she thinks about it, about standing on an IndyCar Series podium, and the phone call from who, when, where that landed her in supercars in Australia. Of course, as always with the V8 Sleuth podcast, we have let you ask questions, and Simona has answered plenty of them in our Couch Racer questions section. As usual, they turned up some really golden responses. So, enough of me. Buckle in, let's get going. Simona Di Silvestro on the V8 Sleuth podcast. Well, we are in the V8 Sleuth headquarters, and Simona Di Silvestro has joined us. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you look a bit nervous, a little bit edgy about doing this podcast. Why?
I don't know, because you said, you know, kind of go through my career and, you know, there's just a lot there, I guess, you know, and maybe you're going to come up with stuff that I don't remember, so.
That's okay. That's fine. Let's start, though, with something that's a bit more recent that will be easy for you to remember.
Yes.
How is it that you ended up coming to Australia to race in supercars? Where did the whole chapter begin, the phone call, the contact, the first approach? What was it, 4 years ago?
Yeah, it was, I think, in 2015, pretty much. I got a phone call to come and do a wild card, actually.
And who rang? Where did this come
Chris,
from?
Actually, Chris Jewell, rang me because I think he was managing Rene at the time. And
that's Rene Gracie who you ended up
exactly.
Driving.
Yeah, exactly. So, so I got the phone call to come and do Bathurst. And for me, you know, it was kind of a dream come true because, you know, I've been really lucky in my career to have, you know, raced in the Indy 500 and done like really big races, and Bathurst was always there. So when I got the phone call, it was kind of a bit of a no-brainer to go and do it because I really wanted to kind of tick it off. And ended up going to do the wild card, and I really enjoyed the series. It was it's just a lot of fun. You know, the cars are quite fun to drive, and the atmosphere of the races are really cool. And then the race kind of went okay, and I met with Katie Page from Harvey Norman, who was sponsoring the Supergirls program at the time, and also with James Warburton. We kind of stayed in contact a little bit, and this deal came together to come for 3 years to race here. So it was like, for me, it was something that I really looked forward to because it was something that had a little bit of continuity, and that was really important to me. And, you know, I wasn't going to come just for 1 year to try it because we know how difficult these cars are and everything. But, I think it was just at the time, it was just really a perfect opportunity and for me to kind of try this out and, you know, try to have a career here in Australia.
So you turned up thinking it was just a one-off. It'll be fun to go and do, tick the box, I've done Bathurst, that was it.
Yeah, literally, yeah, because I was driving Formula E at the time for Andretti, so it was really doing this wild card, and it was a two-year deal, so it was just really fun, and I really just kind of committed to the first one, you know, and then hoping that the second year would work out as well, and and out of that, you know, all these things happened, so, you know, it wouldn't have happened without Harvey Norman, because, you know, they're really supportive of me and things like that. And James as well, you know, kind of orchestrating this, getting us kind of together. It was a big deal. And I think, you know, I was pretty lucky to you know, I think for once being at the right spot at the right time, I guess.
When you say for once, there's probably been times in your career you've been at the wrong place at the wrong time
I think most of my career, it's been like that.
We're going to get to that.
Yeah, it was just a perfect opportunity. And for me, like, you know, when I do something, I really commit to it and really want to do it right. And having the 3 years was really something pretty sustainable to try to deliver the result.
And you got to come and live in Australia. I mean, seriously.
Although you did
leave Melbourne. We were really upset when you decided to move to the sun in Queensland, but yeah, probably a smart move. Really.
Yeah. I really like it up in Queensland, actually. I don't think I'd move back. Actually, today it's a really sunny day, which is pretty remarkable here in Melbourne.
The day that we're recording this here in the office, it is 25 degrees and blue sky out the front. It's the best day we've had in Melbourne in about 6 months.
I know, so. I was pretty shocked, actually, about it, like, when I woke up this morning. No, but yeah, you know, I think being European and, like, you know, especially from Switzerland, I don't really have the chance to live close to the ocean. And I felt like, you know, if I can live in Australia, I have the chance to live here, I really want to do the most out of it. And especially, you know, like, in the past, I've always just really, you know, been close to race team and things like that. And then I realized with time, you know, sometimes it's good to also have a bit of a life outside of racing. So yeah, moving to Queensland was quite good because it just gave me a bit of a routine at home and a bit of a normal life, I would say, to kind of get my head away. Sometimes, you know, when you have a crappy weekend, it's also good.
So when you're not in motor racing world, mm-hmm. What are you into? What do you like? What do you do?
I like playing golf. And
are you any good, though?
Yeah, I'm okay, actually.
Handicap?
It's like 19. Yeah, it's all right. It's like I'm a bogey golfer. Like, I just need to play more. I think that's the thing. But yeah, I really enjoy that. You know, I like, you know, being outside, going mountain biking and things like that. So it's quite fun. I tried to surf, which is still a failure after 3 years. But yes, that's where we're at. Yeah.
Worked all right. Tell me what you thought when you first drove a V8 supercar, because they're different to, I mean, we say it all the time, they're different to anything anywhere else in the world. But because I think you drove an older car up in Queensland before you went to Bathurst. So what was your first thought when you actually drove one of these things? I thought, oh my God, what have I done? This is not an Indy car. Oh my God.
Well, it was pretty crazy because, like you said, I literally landed and then we went to Paul Morris's place and then went up to Queensland Raceway to go and drive. And it was pretty crazy because, like, the 2 years before, you know, I did the Indy car and I was testing in F1. And then did the Formula E, and then all of a sudden I'm in a V8, which is like,
you're ticking all the boxes.
I thought actually that was like the, you know, and it was the biggest shock because everything else is kind of a bit similar in the sense. And when I got in the V8, it was like way different. Like, first of all, you're sitting on the wrong side, which makes no sense for me, you know, and all your perspective, everything is different because, you know, I'm not sitting in the middle. So I remember the first, I kept having my left wheels in the grass because I didn't
know where you were.
I didn't know, like, my, you know, my body and center of gravity or whatever it was, like, wasn't where it's supposed to be. So that took a little bit of adjustment. And then, how to drive the car. It just, you know, as a driver, it's like when you come from go-karts and go to cars or whatever, the first few days or whatever, few months, it just feels really weird. You're not, like, one piece with the car. And that's really how it felt when I got in the V8 that first day.
It's worked out okay because you stayed.
Yeah.
You've come back. You've kept coming back. You haven't just run away and left after a year or two. Tell me about when you went back the next year to Bathurst, because you'd been in a Falcon the first year with, well, ProDrive, it was called there. It's Tickford now. And then you went back with a Nissan, still as a wild card with Renee Gracie again. I think you finished 14th on memory. Like, it was a really good result. What did you learn from the first year that you could apply in the second year? Did it start to make sense?
Yeah, it did. I think the driving made sense. And I think also because the event is so big, you kind of know what to expect a little bit. And, you know, there's not everything is new. You knew the track and you could, I could, like, focus a bit more on what I need to do in the car, where I think the first time you go there, you know, everything is just, the car is strange to drive. The track is pretty crazy. So just a lot of things kind of happening at the
media.
Same time.
And there's less media. The first time around, there was a lot. And it didn't help when a certain driver made some comments that got all sorts of attention as well. Yeah, it did,
but, you know, I don't, it's funny, like, people, like, I forget about this, like, so, like, yeah, I must have really bad memory and things like that.
My name is Aaron.
Exactly.
How have you felt welcomed or accepted in the supercars paddock by the drivers, your own team, other teams, compared to the, I guess, the atmosphere in an IndyCar paddock or Formula One or Formula E or wherever you've been? Is it friendlier? Are the drivers more matey? What's the take on here in supercars in Australia?
They're definitely more matey. I think I have more drivers' friends here than I've ever had anywhere.
Really?
Yeah, it's pretty weird, I think. So, it's actually quite cool in this paddock. You know what? IndyCar is a bit similar, but not as friendly, I would say. And I think now I've arrived, I think, like, I have the respect from the other drivers. I think it takes a little bit of time every time you come to a new series, but definitely everybody's, like, really nice. You know, like, it's really weird to actually walk into, like, a meeting room and everybody's talking to each other, which in Europe is not the case. So it's quite strange in the beginning, but it's quite fun. And it makes it fun because it makes it like a kind of a big family in the paddock, and everybody talks to each other, which is, it's pretty nice.
That's until they stove your door in.
Exactly.
And then from there, it's all downhill. Hey, rewind. Take me way back. I know we have discussed this away from microphones and the like in the past, but where did this crazy Simona is a car racing driver thing start? Is this ingrained by your family? Was someone influential as a youngster in Switzerland? Oh. How did this all start? It's like a bug. It's a germ. Where did it get into you?
I think it started when I was a baby. So, like, my parents say that I was only quiet as a baby when Formula One was on TV. So I'm blaming my dad a little bit on it. And it's funny, my mom actually told me last week that, she was so happy to have a girl so she didn't have to go to watch, like, racing and stuff like that, and it was completely the opposite. So it totally, like, failed her expectations. But yeah, I my dad really liked racing. He watched Formula One on TV. He's kind of an instructor, and he has a car dealership.
Is it
in
a driving instructor?
Yeah, driving instructor. So he has a car dealership in Switzerland. So
what does he sell?
Oh, I can't say right now. No, I can't say anymore now, you know.
a brand of car that shouldn't be connected to you.
Exactly. No, he sells Opels and Mazdas. Yes.
That's okay.
That's okay. So I kind of grew up around cars and all that. And when I was four, he did like a go-kart demonstration and on the parking lot of the dealership. And I really wanted to try it, and I couldn't reach the pedals. And I cried so much that day, and I think it annoyed my dad so much. I annoyed my dad so much because I wanted to drive by myself, and he took me around, like, on his knees, and we cruised around, but I didn't like that. So he said, I'll get you a go-kart when you're a little bit taller. So pretty much every 2 weeks or, like, months, I was, like, telling him, oh, I grew a little bit, let's go to the go-kart
shop. 2 centimeters this
week. Exactly. So 2 years later, finally, the day arrived where I got my first go-kart. So so that's how it kind of really started. You know, it was just for fun, but somehow I liked racing, and it was, it must be in me.
It's in.
Yeah.
And once it's in, it doesn't get out. Where did it go from, this is fun, I like this? And the great irony is that you're from a country where motor racing was banned.
Yes.
After Le Mans, 1955, for those who might not know, was a terrible accident. A lot of people were killed, sadly, and Mercedes withdrew from world motor racing, and to the point where Switzerland actually banned the sport. So.
Which is crazy because we, like, hill climb is allowed, which I think is, like,
I think that's still motorsport, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a million times more dangerous than, like, closed circuit racing. But, yeah, we have this thing. So, yeah, it's banned. It actually just reopened now 2 years ago for Formula E, actually. It was the first time there was a closed circuit race again in Switzerland, which is pretty crazy because we're quite a few good drivers in coming out of Switzerland.
One that springs to mind that we've seen here a bit is Alain Menu, champion.
Exactly. Yep. So it's pretty funny. So how it kind of went from there was, I think I must have been eight or something like that. I was just really fun. And then the guy who ran the go-kart shop said, like, oh, why don't we enter a race with Simona? And then my dad was like, She's a girl. Like, what is she going to do there? And, I only found that out, like, maybe, like, a year ago that he said that. So, yeah, I was pretty disappointed. No, So we entered this first race, and I kind of remember it because it was raining, and it was, like, Sebastian Buemi had just won, like, the Swiss championship in minis, and then there was this other kid who had just won, and it was raining, and I won the race. So somehow I like driving in the rain, but yeah, I won the race. So I won my first ever race, which was pretty cool, and yeah, that's where it pretty much kept going, I guess.
Yeah, that started it all. Yes. So how ironic is it that he didn't think you're going to be any good, and then you won your first race?
Exactly.
I hope his tune changed.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he did. He's really supportive. He's actually always been, you know, like, but yeah, it's a funny comment. But, you know, without my parents, I wouldn't be here. You know, we spend pretty much every holiday on a go-kart track and things like that. So it's, kind of thanks to them that I'm here for sure.
Brothers, sisters, only child?
Only me. So
it's all about you.
Exactly. So
that
I think I'm lucky.
Well.
Yeah,
if you're going to be in motor racing, be an only child.
Be an only child. But yeah, I don't think I would have been a racing driver if I had siblings, to be honest.
You probably first popped up to our radar as motorsport followers here in Australia when you went to the States. Mm-hmm. What took you there? Why America?
Well, money, like always in racing. I think it was 2005. I did Formula Renault Championship in the Italian Championship, and we kind of didn't have the money. We didn't have the sponsorship.
And this is family backing you
to
try to get there.
Did you have like, some help? Yeah, it was a bit like my dad, like, asked some friends, and so we kind of got a bit of money together to go and do this, and yeah, and that was kind of it at that point. At the end of that year, we were like, oh, it's not going to be possible to go and ask for more money, for more support to go racing. So we kind of found ourselves a bit in a pickle in that sense. But then
hang on, did you say in a pickle?
In a pickle.
Is that something you've picked up in Australia,
maybe,
or did you have before?
You like that?
That's good.
Are you like, you're really
Wait, don't
smiley
worry,
right
I,
now?
I think that's good.
So yeah.
There's our pull-out quote for the promotion for the podcast.
But yeah, so then I was, we didn't know what to do really. And a good friend of my dad, his son was racing, and he knew a team that was an Italian team that was racing in Formula BMW in America. And through some connections or through my dad, we found a sponsor in America to go race there. So I went there to do Formula BMW in 2006.
How old
I think
are
I
you
was
both
17.
Such?
Yeah.
Right. Yes. So you're not legally old enough to drink.
Yeah.
To just spend anything in America.
No, well, it was, you know, it was, I know everybody says, oh, it's kind of crazy, but, you know, for me, I was like, okay, that's my only shot at becoming
I'm
a race
it.
Car, like, and it didn't really matter. And also my parents, you know, like with school and all that, there was this big thing, you know, about me kind of stopping school in the middle of, like, not finish my maturity. I don't know how it works here in Australia.
We never mature.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's like year 11 or whatever, and so it was a bit like, oh, let's take the chance. You know, if it doesn't work out, you always can come back, but let's do it. If you do it properly. And here I go. I went to America when I was 17.
Mm-hmm. And then Atlantics, which was like a feeder series through there.
Yes.
And some of our – when we do the research for these podcasts, that's why I paused here, because I have to explain something for a second. Will Dale, who's a big part of our V8 Sleuth team, he's our audio engineer, he's our researcher, he does a bit of everything. And when we sit down and do these podcasts, I basically just write one page of notes out of the top of my head, a bit of research, Will throws in some thoughts as well, and we come up with a few things. And he said one thing that I'd forgotten, that one of you actually had probably your most famous worldwide teammate in Atlantics, but not because he was a racing driving name who won Grand Prix or Indy 500s, because he was off Malcolm in the Middle.
Yes. Yeah.
Frankie Muniz.
He was actually Malcolm, yeah.
Yeah.
Frankie's such a, like, awesome person. Like, and it was funny because he, when I did Formula BMW, that was kind of his first year going into racing.
And did you know who he was?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, who doesn't know him? Come on. He's like, and because he's like way older, but he looks exactly the same. So, you know, it's like you cannot miss him. He's exactly the same person. But yeah, so it was funny because, when I did Formula, I was a bit of a fan as well. So I remember like, hey, can I take a picture like with you? And then we were teammates like 3 years later. So it was really funny. And, you know, I lived in Scottsdale close to where he lived. So we spent a lot of time together. And he's a just really fun character. I remember one road trip going from, we were testing in California and we drove back to Phoenix in a, he had like this smart car. And we up the hill, we had to draft the trucks because the thing would not go any faster. So yeah, it's pretty funny. Yes.
The time we drafted trucks
exactly,
in a smart car.
And you can see me and Frankie, you know, like in this smart car, trying to draft trucks to get up the hill.
I'm trying to picture it.
Exactly.
IndyCar's obviously a big chapter of your career so far. Where did the door open to get you into IndyCars? I think it was 2010, if I remember.
Yeah, 2010. So I did 3 years of Atlantics, and I think that was that third year when actually Frankie was my teammate. I think it was, if I look back, it was like the most important year in my career because the first 2 years, like the first year was average, the second year I had one win in Atlantics, and then it was a bit like, okay, what do we do? And staying that third year, I really had a really good engineer who really taught me a lot. And I got a lot of confidence in myself as well in driving there. And we almost won the championship. I was kind of leading until the last race when I got taken out. So that really gave me a lot of confidence in knowing that, you know, what I'm capable of in a race car. And through that, the same sponsorship kind of opened the door to join HVM, which was a smaller team in IndyCar, and get kind of my first crack at it, I would say. Yeah.
So that was the team that I think for a time Paul Stoddart had been involved in previously.
Exactly.
And Keith Wiggins had been involved with Pacific Formula One,
yes,
which came and went in Formula One pretty quickly. So moving into IndyCar racing, we go Indy 500. It's a highly competitive series. At that time, it was the old generation car compared to what came later on. How were you accepted? How did you approach it? Because at the time, a bit different to what we have in Australia, probably in that period that you're in Atlantics and IndyCar, there was obviously Danica Patrick was a big deal in IndyCar racing. You still had the separation between Champ Car and the Indy Racing League, as it was then.
No, I think
IndyCar
it was
series.
Like, it just came together.
It came in 2008.
Yeah, yeah.
But prior to that, there'd been kind of both series were looking to have female drivers in there as obviously a talking point and a relevant point. By 2010, it was all back together, which was great. So it wasn't like you were the only girl.
No.
There was women in motorsport in the United States at that level everywhere. So you didn't have that kind of, you know, you're the one that everyone then goes to as the media attention and the like. Is that the right way to look at it?
Yeah.
There's never really been an issue over there.
No, yeah, that's true. And, you know, I think Danica, when she was there, you know, she had quite a big popularization, you know, because she'd done pretty well, like, when in the IRL days. And when I got in, I think at the Indy, I don't know if it was 2010, but I think we were five girls who qualified or something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's funny, like, you say all these things, and I never look at it this way. You know, I think I'm looking at it more now that I'm older.
You were just trying to make the car
go
fast.
Yeah, I'm just like,
that's
whatever,
all,
you know,
all
I just want to go fast and don't really care. It was quite, you know, there was me, there was Danica, there was Anna Beatrice, there was Pippa, and then, I think even Catherine, like, came. I don't think if she was in 2000, I'm not sure about that. But yeah, anyway, so there were quite a few, and it was quite interesting, definitely at the time, yeah.
Speaking of interesting, was that the year that you ended up with that fire?
Yeah.
It was Texas.
Texas.
And you were, for those who might not have seen it, jump on YouTube, you'll find it somewhere. But
yes,
you were basically stuck in a burning car.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, and that video is actually, I think it's everywhere for the fire marshals to know what not to do, because pretty much everything went wrong in that scenario. So it looks really spectacular.
So explain for those who haven't seen
so
it what
I,
happened.
Yeah, so I made a mistake. Well, it was actually, I think, my first crash in oval. And, you know, when you start oval racing, they always say, you know, you don't want to be loose. And when you come from a road course background, you think you can handle it. And, couldn't handle it. So, yeah, to kind of hit the wall, and somehow, like, the oil kind of caught fire, and the car really caught on fire. And then I think the marshals were trying to pull out the extinguisher, but nothing was really working, and they were trying to pull me out like sideways, which doesn't work so much.
The headrest was
still
on the car.
My foot was actually stuck. So yeah, it looked like really spectacular, but it wasn't too bad, to be honest. But yeah, definitely when you watch it on YouTube, it's pretty spectacular. But yeah, IndyCar says they always show this video of what not to do, you know, and usually they're really good, you know. I think their safety crew is pretty amazing. They're like right there and then, and I think we learned a lot from that incident, I would say.
You needed them again.
Yes,
at Indy the
unfortunately.
Next year, didn't you?
Exactly.
Something, there was a bit of a thing with you getting toasted in IndyCar.
I've had like
there.
Three fires, so hopefully now it's done. But yeah, 2011, we're like that was a really big one. I think that was the first time like I kind of... Yeah, it was actually, you know, the first time I realized like I'm not that invincible. So I had a suspension failure, and I think I was going like 340
k's
an hour. Yep, kind of the car flipped, hit the fence, and it was really big. Like the tub was really like broken, and the roll hoop was off, and because the roll hoop was off, like all the fuel kind of came out, and I was upside down, and I was like on fire, and I was in the car, and I wasn't sure I could get out, to be honest. But then, thankfully, the rescue came pretty quickly, and sprayed with the fire extinguisher and kind of woke me up again and got out. And there I burned my hands pretty badly, so it was not ideal, I would say.
But they patched you together, didn't they?
And
you went and had to go back and qualify.
They did. Well, I got out of the car, and I was like, I'm done. Like, I don't want to race anymore, because it really, really spooked me. And it's funny, because my mom is usually more the scared person, and my dad is like more, oh, you gotta do it.
Were they there that day?
No, they were actually flying over.
Oh.
So when they landed, like their phone was blowing up and everything, and I was in the hospital and all that. But but then my mom actually came in, and my dad was like, oh, you know, if you want to stop, it's fine. But my mom was like, hey, you should try it at least. And because she told me that, it kind of was like, she's right, you know. And it was this thing, it happened on Thursday before qualifying. And then on Saturday, I went out and qualified the car on pole day. Made it into, I think it was like the top 24 at that point.
With bandaged hands.
Yeah, it was like the medical crew like really looked really well after me. But and kind of got it patched up. It was not comfortable to drive, because, you know, when you have burns, like every time you move, your skin reopens. It was this thing. I told myself, you know, if I get in the car and I have a smile on my face, I should keep going. If I'm spooked, then I'm just done. So luckily for me, I went out and qualified the bloody thing. But it was pretty scary, because on an oval, you take the wing off to go faster, and the car gets pretty loose, and you feel like you hang on. I think that's in my racing career, the toughest thing is qualifying car at the Indy 500. Because it's just really scary, and you just got to really commit for four laps. And when we went out, we were like just missing a little bit, and we had not run less wing, and we just did it. And I remember on the third lap going into turn three, and it just moved a little bit. And all I was telling myself was like, okay, we just got to do one more lap here and just hang on. And then we did it. So yeah, it's a big courage thing, which was a pretty crazy at the time.
Some of our listeners will have been to the Indy 500, mm-hmm. Many will have seen it on television. I don't think you ever understand it until you physically actually go to the speedway for even if it's just a practice day or qualifying, let alone the actual race day, which is mammoth.
Crazy.
It's the biggest single day sporting crowd in the mm-hmm. world. Depending on the numbers that you hear, it's anywhere from 300 to 400,000 people. That's, you know, the AFL Grand Finals, 100,000 at the MCG. That's three or four times that.
It's crazy.
It's bigger than an Olympics opening ceremony. It's bigger than a World Cup soccer final. Think of the biggest sports events, and they still do not compare to that. But you're smiling just as I'm talking about the Indy 500. It's something it's a phenomenally amazing event to watch, to take in, but to actually be in it.
Yeah.
And they treat their history with amazing reverence there too, that, you know, you didn't win the race, you didn't get to the pole position, but if you started, what, four or five of them, you're in the history books.
Yeah, you are. Yeah. It's quite cool. And I won Rookie of the Year in 2010. So I'm like in a cool list with like a lot of cool names in there. So we never know what the future holds. But yeah, it'd be cool to do it one more time for sure. Yeah.
I'm sure we can find a way.
There you go.
There'll be a deal to be had there somewhere. That was at a time when IndyCar racing was about to change because there was new cars that came in later. And obviously there was that last race in Vegas that was horrendous for we all know what happened there with Dan Weldon's accident. And do you think IndyCar racing changed that day forever?
I think going to that track was something that none of us really wanted to go because for an IndyCar it just doesn't really make that much sense. And
and we're talking, for those who don't know, about the sort of the 1.5 mile heavily steeply high banked oval. So they're stuck on
flat out. And I remember that day, like we were driving and it was ridiculous because you would be it was like pack racing and you were just flat out and like with 26 cars just going at it. And what happened was, I think, pretty shocking for all of us because as a racer, you never think about those things. And all of a sudden, like one of, you know, your teammates is gone. And I think like for me, it was pretty tough for all of us just to deal with that. And and I think it changed, you know, and it's unfortunate circumstances like this. But it was definitely a pretty, pretty difficult moment, I would say. Yeah.
What's the standout memory for you from that day?
Oh, it was weird because like I remember I was actually side by side with Dan at one point and then I got kind of chopped off. So like I had to go like on the apron and come back. And thanks to that, I wasn't right in the middle there when that happened. And it was really weird. Like when we passed the car, like you just had this feeling like we couldn't see anything, but like it was just like you had this feel, oh, something was really wrong. And and it was just, you know, I was just, I don't know, it's a crazy experience. I think, you know, when, yeah, you never think about those things. But definitely, I think on ovals, like after that, you know, in racing, I never thought, you know, oh, something could happen. But when you're racing on ovals, because it is so quick, there's always a big chance that you can really hurt yourself. And I think since that day, you know, a lot of us also have that had in mind, which we usually don't really have that. But, you know, I think the safety has done really improved and things like that. But you know, for sure, you know, you still, you know, at Indy, I think top speed is like 360-370 next to a concrete wall. So it's still crazy. But you know, that's we like this as well. You know, we like kind of living on the edge. But definitely, yeah, that was, I think, pretty shocking moment. Yeah,
The new cars came for the next year, and you ended up in a slug.
Yeah.
But how did you end up in that Lotus, which, for those who may not follow IndyCar racing, the Lotus brand has such great history, but unfortunately it didn't come through that year, where to the point where I think cars were you one of them where you were waved off at the Indy 500 because you were too slow. They just said, go to the pits.
It made no sense. And to be honest, it was a waste of a year. And it was, I think, a bit of poor management, to be honest, in the team, you know, I think.
And that was the same team that you...
Yeah, it was the same team, you know, and that just shows sometimes, you know, people just want money, you know, maybe money over, you know, like performance and things like that. And it was really frustrating because we had good sponsorship package deal and it was just really a waste of a year.
And the engine was...
Yeah, it was just no good. It was just, you can't compete with it. Like, it just... I think it was just poorly managed in the sense. And then it wasn't developed like properly or anything like that. And it was just too, like on an oval, it was ridiculous. I think one race, like after like six laps, they were already lapping us. And you like flat chat. Like, you know, so.
I'm not a bad driver, it's I swear. Like,
so it's just, and it's weird because, you know, you just, because on Noval, everything happens so quickly, it just can't happen. So, I think it was really frustrating year for me, like for my engineer and all that, because, you know, you just go to the racetrack not to be competitive. So it's frustrating.
Did you get to the point there where there had been other opportunities that you had turned down to stay there? Was the phone ringing? How did...
Well,
there's always in drivers' careers, I could have, I should have, I would have.
Yeah,
I said
there's
no.
A lot of them.
What's the one that stands out? Was there something in IndyCar racing? If you can't figure this out, we're looking for the headline for the podcast.
Yeah,
here,
I know.
What's the IndyCar drive that you turned down that you could have been at?
Yeah, well, it's a bit hard to say because at the time I was managed by someone that didn't really, you know, like, involve me in a lot of things. So I think, yeah, after the years you hear of stories. So and I think that was a bit my mistake a little bit, you know, and just really just trusting one person and dealing with all of these things. So
was that you going, here, I just want to focus on driving
the race
car?
Well, I think I was really
or?
Young, you know, and it was, you know, I don't know, I was like 20 or 21 around there, and I was racing and you know, like at the time you never think about those other things. All you think is about going quick in a race car, and with age I would say it would be smarter to actually be involved in, not even like not fully involved, but know what is going on exactly. Yeah. And I think that was my mistake a little bit, and I think just not being you know, fully aware of what was going on, and so it just kind of that Lotus thing was kind of a good example that it wasn't the right thing to do, but we somehow the next year kind of managed to turn the curve. But I think you know, if I would have been in a bigger team or anything like that, things could have looked a little bit differently.
Well, you got to a bigger team, so you got to what was KV Racing.
Yes.
So a bit of an Australian connection there. Kevin Colcoven, who partner in that team, mm-hmm. who had been a partner in what was Champ Car and basically saved it when Kart was about to fold. And then ran a team for quite a long time, invested a lot of money in American Open Wheeler Racing. But that was a team that then, I think that was that not the year that Tony Kanaan won the 500 with KV? So they were a team that was, suddenly you had a car that you could actually play with.
Definitely, like it was definitely a step. It was the Penske's or the Ganassi's or the Andretti's.
But it's better than where you were.
Yeah, it was definitely a step up going there. And the cool thing, I had my engineer actually that I worked with the year before with the Lotus. It was just like we worked really well, and he was actually engineering Frankie in 2009 when we were doing Atlantic, Gerald Tyler.
Yeah.
And because he did that all this in 2009 with us, like he was in the same thing. Like he knew what I was capable of, and I knew like he would give me the tools to be successful. So I was really pumped in going into that that year. And it started off a bit weirdly. You know, I had Kanaan as my teammate, and he's a, you know, proper figure, likes to run the team his way and things like that. And when you come in as the new kid, you know, you have to kind of earn your stripes a little bit. And I think we really managed that. You know, mid-season towards the end, we were consistently like, really quick, and finally got one podium in Houston, which was pretty cool. You know, I always knew we could do it, and just, you know, things pieced together, having the car do what I like it to do, that was really cool.
So you got that podium. You did do some more races for Andretti a couple of years later, but do you feel like your IndyCar chapter is a bit unfulfilled of what it could have been?
Is it
a bit like?
I think so. You know, I think if I would have ended up like in a big team, I think, you know, I could have won races. You know, even with TK, you know, he's won a championship, he's won an Indy 500, and he was my teammate. Then, you know, towards the end, I was usually the quicker car in the team. So that just shows, I think, that the capabilities were there. But, you know, like always, you have to be at the right time, at the right place. You have to have teams that want to, you know, have your back, and it seems like that, you know, I don't know if it could have happened or not, like that's what I mean, like I wasn't really that much aware of what was really going on, but I think it could have been different, you know, on one side it's cool, like I had a podium and all that, but for sure, you know, I think I think I could have stayed, you know, in the sense, and have a good career there.
Yeah, but you came to Australia to enjoy some sun. So we win, they lose.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's a win for us. In that whole time, the Iron Maiden nickname is affixed to you. Who started that? Where did that come from?
The fans, actually.
Really?
It came from 2011, from the crash. It's really...
They're like, she's a tough chick.
Yeah, exactly. That's how it... Because when I came to America, like it was like the Swiss Miss... which was...
Tell me you hate it, don't you?
Like, I didn't like it. I was like, it's just a bit lame, you know?
What do your friends call you?
And it's like Martina Hingis's nickname already. So I was like, I can't be like Swiss Miss 2.
But what do your friends call you? What's your nickname to them?
Oh, it's just Sim. It's pretty boring. Okay. But yeah, so the Iron Maiden is way cooler. Yeah. So it's actually because, yeah, I qualified the car like 2 days later that, yeah... They called me the Iron Maiden. And at the time, I didn't know it was a band as well. So it was just this whole new world, like within like 1 day opening.
Wait, so they rocked up with t-shirts the next day. Yeah, oh my God, they've made t-shirts already.
Exactly. No, not that it's bad. But then it's I was like, oh, yeah. So yeah. And I thought that it's cool. It's a cool nickname.
It is a cool nickname. Mm-hmm. It is a very cool nickname. Yes. And there's no one else in motor racing that's got it. So you can't ever be confused with anybody else.
Yeah.
Hey, tell me about the Formula One little era that started but didn't really start. You tested with Sauber. Mm-hmm. What went wrong? Why did you not end up further there? You read the things online about what unfolded there, and
yeah,
I'm sure there's certain things you can't go into, but there's certain elements that you can. So it would have all made sense. Swiss driver, Swiss
it
team.
Makes sense. Funny how things always make sense, yeah. Right? My goal was always Formula One. Like even when I was in IndyCar, like I always had these fixtures. That, you know, that was my ultimate goal to get there. And after 2014, things were going pretty well. And kind of got this opportunity with Sauber.
And was this them offering you? Was this going to them? I've got some backing.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know how it works in racing. Mm. You need to have some backing. So I had a little bit of backing from what we had. At the time, we didn't really have the full budget to stay in IndyCar. And it was just... Yeah, kind of a bit frustrating, to be honest, because I felt like, you know, I'd proven that I can be quick but it just was there. And then this kind of opportunity came with Sauber, and, you know, me like being like having my little Formula One eyes, you know, be like, oh, that looks amazing. I did a few tests and it went really well. And at the time, I think Sauber was in a really tough situation. You know, they were really struggling for money. So they had a few drivers signed up and got a bit messy because they were really struggling for money, and I definitely did not have the money that they needed for me to go racing there. So yeah, unfortunately that chapter kind of closed pretty quickly, but you know, and that's just how it shows how motorsports sometimes can be cruel, kind of outside of your hands a little bit. And I was not depressed, but definitely I think pretty... You know, I was, it kind of put me down quite a lot, because, you know, when you always have this aim and thing, you're always looking at that, and all of a sudden it's kind of not there, not because you're not performing or anything. It's just because there's no money or something like that. It can be pretty frustrating, yes.
It always comes back to money.
Exactly.
Somewhere, somehow, it always comes back. And one of the things we do at V8 Sleuth, we track the histories of race cars.
Mm-hmm.
We love the history of the sport. We love to ask drivers about their own memorabilia, their helmets, their suits. We find that drivers are on a scale between they keep everything. They're like those hoarders on those TV shows that you open their doors and they're just overfilling with stuff, or they don't care. They give it away, they sell it, they do whatever. Where are you on the scale of hoarder and non-hoarder?
I'm like, I think I would say in the middle. So I keep one race suit from every year. And usually my helmet as well stay with me, except, you know, like some sponsor. Like I think two of my biggest sponsors from back in the day have a helmet. But yeah, that's where I'm at. And the rest kind of, nah, can't deal with it. My mom already annoys me with how many race suits there is. Like,
you're all at home.
Yeah, like at home. She's like, when are you going to come and get those? And I'm like, well, you know, maybe one day.
One day.
Exactly.
If you could own a race car from your career, what would you own?
Oh, that's in
the- if money wasn't an issue.
Actually, I think I would buy the Atlantic car from 2009 because that was, I feel like that was really the car and the year that kind of made me who I am a bit, you know, and I think that's a really good memory and could be a pretty fun car to go drive around the track sometimes.
So do we need to start a sleuthing project to find that car?
We should, yes,
okay.
We should.
You find me a chassis number and we'll go dig. We'll go dig. We'll find an old Indy car as well. While we're at it. One of the other things we do on our podcast is we open it up to the fans.
Mm-hmm.
Couch racer questions.
Perfect.
We got lots.
Lots.
When we told them it was you.
Oh, it's scary.
Now,
I'm prepared.
You ready? Right. Andrew Ferris asks, and we'll be really quick fire with these. What's your recommendations to any international driver looking to make the switch to full-time supercar racing?
Forget everything you've kind of learned and, yeah, start from scratch.
Fair enough. Merv Hardiman says, do you think you were a bit of a target? Every time you started to do well in a race, someone would bump you off the track.
Yeah, that's funny because it seems like, because these cars, you can do that, yeah? Yeah, it seems like it, but, you know, we can bump back, so... You know, that's the thing we're doing now.
You give as good as you get. Travis Robson says, what's your best advice for females wanting to start racing at any level of motorsport?
Oh, I think just kind of, you know, like believe in yourself and really, you know, get people around you involved in kind of your dream or whatever you want to do because it's not an easy sport. You need a lot of people around you to kind of make it happen.
Makes sense. Jason asks, what's your favorite and not so favorite track in Australia?
My favorite, well, Bathurst because it's bad, but I really like Newcastle because I think it's.
Well, you go good.
Well,
there
I go
too.
Good. Yeah, that's usually how it works.
You are the passing champion of Newcastle.
Now everybody knows about it, though, so it's kind of.
It's not
jinxed.
A secret.
Yeah, it's
anymore.
Not a secret anymore, thanks to TV.
Sorry.
But
worst.
I don't know. Actually, there's not really well.
Don't be fearful of offending anyone.
No, I'm not. I'm just going through them quickly, you know. And
we're going to be here all day. You do the calendar in your brain.
Yeah, maybe. I don't really like Winton that much, to be honest. It's not my favorite.
It's only been your test track for three and a half years, but anyway.
Exactly.
Jason Abercrombie asks, hey, Simona, have you got into any Australian sports while you've been here?
Well, I did the thing with Harvey Norman and the Giants.
GWS like, Giants,
yes,
the AFL.
Yes.
Yep.
I did kick the ball a few times. And I actually managed to do a banana kick, whatever that thing is called.
Like, did it go through the goals?
Like first time out. It was like
they could have used you on grand final day this
year. Everybody was pretty impressed, actually. But then I can't figure out how to throw the ball like that.
Oh, bounce
yeah,
it.
Yeah, bounce it. It's impossible. So I tried that. Well, I tried surfing. That's pretty much about it at the moment.
Have you picked a team in any of the sports to follow?
But not
I
really.
Said this to you 4 years ago when you first turned up.
I know, but the thing is, what's a bit confusing is that all the teams are in Melbourne. You know, like when I was
not
in America, I lived in Indy and I was like, okay, I'll go for the
that's
Colts.
Easy. Yeah, Colts, you know? Pacers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You just and here you really got to like actually
well,
make
now
some
that you
research.
Live in Queensland in the AFL, it's Lions or Suns.
Suns,
that's
yeah.
It.
Oh, I
that's
went it. To a Suns game, yeah.
Yeah. So you know the names. Exactly. This is good. Okay, so you know what was the line you wheeled out earlier? What was the thing that I said that you said?
In a pickle.
In a pickle. Gold. I just want to hear you say it again. Rolf asks, favorite food you've discovered in Australia?
Oh, favorite food. I like sausage rolls. We don't have them in Switzerland.
I love them too.
Yeah.
Tomato sauce?
Yes.
Yeah.
Ketchup.
Yeah. Tomato sauce. Yeah. Same difference. This is a question from Mr. G. Jacobson of Shepparton in Victoria.
Wow.
Who is your favorite teammate?
I have to say Gary because it's him asking the question. So, you know, I don't get in trouble next time I walk into the truck.
Another one here. This is from a Miss R. Crean of the Gold Coast. Who is your favorite supercars pit reporter?
Rihanna!
It's good to see that the industry's reading our social media pages before we start to do this podcast. Tyler Williams asks, what was it like driving for Andretti in IndyCar in 15? Was there a chance for you to go full-time there in 16?
I tried because I had this whole F1 thing kind of fall apart. So I scrambled to find a little bit of money to try to go back to IndyCar and got enough money to actually do 3 races. But then, yeah, no more money. Dreams is finished. No, actually, it didn't. But yeah, it actually just created the opportunity to go do Formula E with them. So it was okay. It, yeah, exactly.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Another thing we do is the top 10 shootout. Mm-hmm. We do it in supercars, one car on the track at a time. Who can go fastest gets the pole position. In our top 10 shootout, I drop 10 things, names of people, places, things, and you give me the first word that comes to mind.
Oh, okay.
We will allow you to have two words or three words if you need them. But by the end, most of our guests find that they end up at one word.
One
answers.
Word, okay.
You ready?
I'm ready.
You look really nervous.
Yeah, because this thing.
Your hand's gone up to your cheek and you're starting to get.
I need to think.
It's okay. Ready? First thing that comes in your head, don't think. That's the secret to this game. Indy 500.
Fast.
Fair point. Tony Kanaan.
Nice.
Formula E.
Electric.
Anything else?
Interesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
David Reynolds.
Weird.
Rick Kelly.
Well, he's weird as well, actually. He's weird and nice.
Weird in what way?
He's just, like yesterday, every time he finishes
this was
the test.
Okay, when we're recording this is at the pre-Bathurst
test. Actually, last test we did earlier in the year, the day is finished and he walks out like from the garage in his socks. To his car, and yet
I presume with other things on, not just
but his suit and his socks, and then now pre-Bathurst says, I'm like there, and he walks out barefoot out of the garage. He's just really awkward.
He just doesn't
wear
shoes.
But it's kind of fun to be around. But actually pretty quiet, I would say. Yeah.
Yeah, we say quiet because you use weird for Reynolds.
Yes,
so,
quiet.
Yeah, you can't reuse words.
No,
that's the other rule I forgot to tell you about. Yeah, yeah. Todd Kelly.
Intense.
Katie Page.
Amazing.
Derek Walker.
Good person.
That's two words, but I'll let you get away with it. Bathurst.
Can I use two words?
Yeah, I'll let you.
Best place. Most fun place.
That's three words.
Yeah, sorry.
We'll put a hyphen.
That's how you describe it.
We'll put a hyphen in there and it'll get it down to two. And I must have had a vibe of what you're going to say earlier. Winton.
Hate it. Well, it's just hate.
No. Oh, we love our friends at Winton Motor Raceway. It's a great regional facility.
It is actually all right.
And I know that you're saying it because we're making you pick something out of all the tracks that you perhaps don't enjoy. But I know there's so many other things that we could touch on. We don't have time. We might do it again another time. You've survived. It was okay.
It was all right.
It didn't hurt.
No, it was good.
Not much. Yeah. Anyway, thank you for sitting down with us. It's been awesome to have you part of the Supercars Championship for the last 3 years. Whatever happens in the future, we hope that you're back. If you're not, we wish you all the very best with whatever's to come next. And by the time this podcast wheels out, we might know the answer on what you're up to next year. So regardless of where that falls or where it doesn't fall, thanks for sitting down with us today and going down memory lane.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it. Thanks again to Simona Di Silvestro for joining the V8 Sleuth podcast and going for a drive down memory lane on her career so far. Now, when she came to our office, she didn't leave empty-handed. She took home a copy of our Ford at Bathurst book, which features every Ford to race in the Great Race from 1963 to 2018. The reason being is because Simona's Falcon from that first Bathurst wildcard in 2015 is in the book. If you haven't got a copy that you can call your own, you can pick one up at our V8 Sleuth online store. And because you're a podcast listener, we will give you a deal. 10% discount, in fact. Head to the V8 Sleuth website, v8sleuth.com.au, click on store. When you get there and you go through the checkout, enter the code FORDBOOK10, all capitals and the number 10 at the end. FORDBOOK10. Now, even if you've already got a copy, don't forget Christmas is coming up soon. And if someone you know is right into their Fords, it's the perfect thing to whack under their Christmas tree. If you're enjoying our V8 Sleuth podcast this year, make sure you leave us a review to help spread the word. Keep an eye on our website and our social media accounts to stay up to date. And until then, we'll see you next time on the V8 Sleuth podcast.